the problem then was that I wasn't expressing what I wanted to express. I wasn't using poetry as a way of understanding myself and my place within the world, and I think that's what I became more able to do in my late 20s.
Welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. That was the voice of the poet and essayist Will Harris. Will's a London-based writer who published his first pamphlet of poems, All This Is Implied, in 2017. It was very well received. It was joint winner of the London Review Bookshop Pamphlet of the Year, and it was shortlisted for the Callum MacDonald Memorial Award. In 2018, he went on to publish the essay Mixed Race Superman. Will is of Anglo-Indonesian heritage, and he writes in the essay about thinking of himself as white when he was a child and then gradually becoming aware that other people saw him as Asian. The essay ties together his own feelings about his ethnicity and his identity with a look at two mixed-race men in the public eye, Barack Obama and Keanu Reeves. And he also looks at how in the UK politicians like Tony Blair talked the talk, superficially applauded multiculturalism, but didn't really address racism or why it was flourishing in the UK. This year, he has published his debut collection of poetry, Rendang, which looks at some of the same issues around cultural identity, but also showcases Will's really innovative, lyrical way of playing with language. I found him lovely to talk to. He's very measured and thoughtful, as you will hear, and I think he's shaping up to be one of the most interesting thinkers of his generation. Before we start the interview, I'm very happy to say that this episode is sponsored by Arvod, the UK's leading provider of residential creative writing courses. So let me take a minute to tell you about that. Arvod's writing houses in Devon, Shropshire and Yorkshire will be back as soon as they're able to open. In the meantime, you can enjoy all the same acclaimed writing tutors, insights and inspiration from your own home. There are readings and masterclasses with authors such as Sebastian Faulks, Deborah Levy and Will Self, as well as whole digital writing weeks on topics like fiction writing and writing for children and young adults. You can also book a one-to-one tutorial with an Arvod tutor of your choosing at your convenience for direct feedback on your work. One course that caught my eye was Sustaining a Writing Practice in Difficult Times, which is a Zoom masterclass aimed at helping you work alongside distraction, disruption, anxiety, and the inner critic. I think we could all probably benefit from that. To find out more and book in, head over to arvod.org. But now back to Will Harris, and we started the interview with him reading a poem from his new collection, Rendang.
Buddleia, not Buddha. Chanting in bloom, my soul before I knowed it, chanting too. I ran down to the tube, and from Gray's Inn Road to Farringdon to the Golden Lane Estate, Buddleia, not Buddha, chanting in bloom. I went not caring where I went, how late it was, or why, but barred at every turn I took, and every church gate chained, Buddleia, not Buddha, chanting in bloom. Grey it grew and far from home until I had to stop. My bundling found me on a bus, and eyes closed there I cried, waiting for the sky to gape and let me crawl inside. Buddleia, not Buddha, chanting in bloom. Buddleia, not Buddha, buddling on my tomb. That's a poem that just came out of my saying the word Buddleia again and again in my head, and thinking that it had some, might have some relationship etymologically to Buddha, and thinking that was, and then I looked it up and obviously it doesn't. It's, there's just a, there was a botanist called Adam Buddle from the 17th century who it's named after, and that was how the poem came.
I don't know what a Buddleia is.
It's just a kind of flower, and it often, it's pretty common. I can't describe it, but it often appears by train tracks and on roadsides. It's kind of purpley. Ah, yeah, it has the kind of, how would you describe it, like cones of purple flower.
Oh, beautiful. So what,
you'll definitely recognize it.
I'll Google it afterwards. So tell me a little bit about the circumstances around writing that one.
So it, I guess a lot of poems my poems in general, come out of words, just repeating words until they sound strange and weird and they kind of take on a little incantatory rhythm or narrative propulsion of their own. And that was entirely the basis of that. Just thinking, I guess I had another poem in the book about Buddha, and I was thinking Buddha, that word. And there's a refrain, or there's a motif through the book of words being repeated and kind of losing meaning in the way that, I guess, racialized epithets can also kind of use the meaning, or like the way you see people can kind of lose its meaning when you don't, when it's just, when it becomes kind of repetitive and not kind of authentic. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so in this case, I just had this word Buddhia and I looked it up and I wrote a poem about going to visit the tomb of the botanist who Buddhia was named after, Adam Buddle. And then I revised that poem several months later to remove all trace of Adam Buddle. And it just became a kind of grimmer, more kind of Blakean poem about London, just kind of going through London and being kind of haunted by words.
Mm. And is that quite typical for you, that you would revise something over possibly a period of months?
Yeah. Yeah, I revise obsessively.
Do you? And,
yeah, kind of too muchly. There's, I think one of the, both the appeals and dangers of poetry is it's something you can just endlessly fiddle with. I think when you're working with in a longer form, like a novel, and I've tried to write novels, you kind of can't fiddle as much because you just, you would actually go insane if you did. But with poems, there's like endless room to just switch words around and change line breaks, especially if you're not working within a strict form, but even then you can.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gives play to a contained form of insanity, or I kind of think of it as like a mix between hysteria and paranoia, where you're kind of pattern finding in that paranoid way, but it's kind of hysterical because it's an overflowing of language as well, so you're kind of trying to rein it in at the same time.
That's interesting. You're trying to rein in an overflowing of language. So do you feel like a lot of your editing is, well, editing I suppose is the word, about sort of pairing it back? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, I think that's the way my practice has developed over the last few years. I think when I started writing, or for the first few years, I would write really painstakingly and kind of weigh every single word as I put it down. And then I realized that was leading to very kind of boring, quite stale work.
Mm.
So I started just trying to force myself to just get words down and onto the page and then to edit afterwards.
Mm.
And I found that was where the more interesting stuff started coming.
How do you know when you're finished?
Ah, that's a good question. You don't. And that's why it's tough. I mean, you show it to your editor if you're lucky enough to have one, or you show it to a friend. That helps. I think, though, you also get the kind of moment of panic after you press send, where you immediately want to change 10 things. But yeah, I think it's just about making peace with what you've written and being okay with it, like entering the world and representing you in some form.
Yeah, it was when you mentioned showing it to an editor, if you have an editor. I've never really thought about poets being edited before. It feels a little bit like a fine artist showing an editor an oil painting and then taking feedback. I mean, it sort of feels a bit something so personal, it feels odd to imagine that it's edited. What is the process of working with an editor on poetry?
I guess there are different forms of editing. So the poetry editor at Granta, Rachel Allen, who's an amazing poet in her own right, she'll give me, I guess, kind of creative feedback often. So sometimes it will be about word choice, line endings, those kind of technical things, but then it will often be about what I'm trying to do, whether I could push it further, whether I could develop something. And then there's obviously the more copy editing, factual side, which I really like, actually. and has been really nice at Granta. There's an editor there called Eleanor Chandler in particular, who worked really closely on the book as well. And her copy editing was just incredible. As in, she just treated it like an article. I mean, obviously she was really attentive to all the things which make it a poem, but she'd be like, are you sure you want to say despite instead of in spite of? Or are you, you know, and just give it, she just gave it the full
kind of rigorous once over.
Yeah. And I also really love that. I know some poets don't. They think it's all kind of graven in stone, and it's kind of sacrosanct. But I think what's exciting about a poem is that it is contingent. It could have turned out 100 other ways, and yeah.
Mm.
I don't mind that it's just one version of it. And I like shaping it with other people. I think it makes it more dynamic.
Yeah. As we talk, are you in the place where you would write?
Well, I mean, if we were talking a few months ago, then I usually write outdoors, or I mean, not literally outdoors, but in cafes, in libraries, and I am at home at the moment, and I've kind of got used to writing here more as a result of lockdown.
Yeah.
Has that
been a tough adjustment?
Well, it's been tough in some ways. I mean, the main reason it was tough was because it was hard to motivate myself at the beginning of lockdown to work on my own writing. I mean, I had some commissions, and I'd been doing a bit of teaching, and that was fine. But doing my own writing, I think that requires a particular kind of motivation,
mm.
kind of belief in the continuation of civilization beyond 2020 in particular. And that was kind of lacking for a period.
That's really interesting. Were you aware that you needed that sense before, or has it just become obvious to you?
No, that was really interesting. It did feel like reckoning with that part of myself which does kind of need validation, I guess. And you kind of can get into a habit of thinking that you're pretty self-contained as a writer, because you know, you're spending most of your time by yourself, you're just doing things for your own, you develop a system of knowing whether you're happy with something and your own practices of reading and writing. But then when this happened, I realized how dependent I was on other people and on all these different structures which allowed me to communicate with other people and to put work in the world. And in a way, you don't really want to think that that's that important to you, because I don't know, it seems kind of narcissistic, you know, the work should be its own reward, but turns out the work was not rewarding when I was at the beginning of lockdown.
In your sort of ideal world, if we were not in lockdown, what would be a sort of great working setup for you in terms of where you would go and what you want background wise?
I like to be outdoors, to be able to move, to have a lot of background noise. I find background noise helps shut out internal noise, and internal noise is the distracting thing.
Do you write every day?
Writing every day is generally a good thing. But I would say also any kind of creative practice outlet. I've been reading a really great book by Marion Milner called On Not Being Able to Paint. I don't know if you know it. She was a psychoanalyst, and she just a really great writer. And it's about using doodles and how they can be these forms of self-analysis. And so she had wanted to be a painter early in her life, and then she'd given it up, and then she'd taken up doodling. And it's a really beautiful book because it includes her doodles and her analyses of her own doodles.
Wow.
And it really makes you want to doodle and to take doodling seriously.
Take doodling seriously. Feels like a slogan.
Which felt quite similar to all the kind of thing I try and say to poets in workshops. Because, you know, everyone has this very high bar when they come in, and they're like, I'm not a writer, I'm not a poet, I can't, you know. And then you get them to write, and you get them to feel good about what they've written. And that's and to realize that that is it. You know, you're doing it. You just have to take the playful stuff more seriously.
Mm. Was writing, you know, from a young age, were you aware that writing was your thing?
I think so.
Was there somebody who got you interested in poetry?
I mean, the poetry came quite a lot later, when I was in my mid-teens, maybe. And I really can't remember what it was that triggered it. I think I had another friend who was more into poetry than me, and he might have shown me a book. I think it might have been an American poet called Wallace Stevens, maybe, and it seemed good. I think I liked it because it was difficult and different, and it wasn't like anything we studied at school. So the poets I got into at first were really kind of difficult, like early 20th century modernists, people who were kind of doing strange fragmented things and quoting stuff in French and Latin, partly as a way of pissing off my teachers, I think. Because I hated poetry at school, like everyone else, because it seemed really boring to me. And we were just taught to unpick it and explain it with this boring toolkit of terms like alliteration and assonance. And I didn't see it as a vital form of communication until this, yeah, I started reading poetry with a friend, and then I started writing it again, I think partly because nobody else I knew was doing it. So it was kind of the opposite of having a mentor figure or a person who introduced me to it. I think it came out of it just seemed entirely different.
Was it a little strange rebellion, do you think, on some level?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, poetry does feel kind of rebellious in that it's like a perverse form of communication. It's very short, but it often doesn't make sense, and it forces you to kind of sit with it and kind of weigh up each word. In fact, yeah, this poet and academic I really love called Veronica Forrest Thompson, who died in really young in the 70s, she always used to quote this thing Wittgenstein said, which is poetry is, he used to say, do not forget that though a poem uses the language of information, it's not involved in the language game of giving information. So a poem uses the language of information, uses the same words that we use day to day that you use in an article, but it doesn't play the game of giving information.
Okay.
As in the game of, you know, pass me the butter, you know, what's happening in the news, that game.
Yeah.
But it uses the same words. And I think that's the thing I always liked about it. That's the kind of perverse streak that runs through poetry, which is that it's using words you understand in ways that you don't normally understand them.
Yeah.
It's making you think about them differently.
Would you talk me through the sort of first few years of your work life, I suppose, you know, leading up to publishing All This Is Implied?
So I started writing poems in my mid-teens. I studied English because I didn't have much of an imagination, and that was probably a mistake. I should have studied something else. I didn't enjoy studying English.
Do you mean at university you studied English?
At university, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, yeah, just because it seemed to make sense. But then as soon as I started studying it, I realized it didn't make sense, because by that point I already wanted to write, and I knew that writing was the thing I loved. And so having to write essays about books and poems, actually, I did find it so much harder than I thought I would. Some poets compare writing about poetry to an animal lover taking up vivisection. And it did feel a bit like that at points. But then I left university. I worked as a teaching assistant at school for a bit. And then I thought about becoming a teacher. I realized that probably wasn't for me. So I did a creative writing master's, which feels in hindsight like going back to the scene of the crime, or just repeating a mistake for a reason. Because that... also didn't go so well. I think it was because it was at a point where I thought I needed to focus on writing, but I didn't really have anything to write about. So I thought, you know, a year of just writing, I managed to get a grant to do it. So it was all paid for But then I got there and it was in St. Andrews, which is a small seaside town, three streets. I'd grown up in London, so I was completely unprepared for how small and remote it was going to be. It doesn't even have a train station. And I had nothing to write about, and I just kind of lost it within a month because I was just tearing my hair out, walking along the beach, had nothing. And I was just kind of counting down the months I had to be there. And that actually kind of took the writing out of me for probably a good few years afterwards.
That's such a shame.
I came back to London, I worked. Well, yeah, it was kind of a shame. But now I kind of see it in a more positive light as maybe a purgative process I needed to go through to purge this idea of the writer I wanted to be or thought I should be in order to just discover what I actually wanted to do or say. Because I think I was just, I don't know, like a lot of young writers and probably young men in particular, just kind of arrogant. I just thought I loved writing and therefore I thought I should be a writer, but I really didn't have anything to write about then, and I didn't even think I should need to think about that, which is incredibly presumptuous. But yeah, I just spent my mid-20s doing odd jobs, doing quite a lot of teaching, mainly tutoring and copy editing things. And I ended up getting back into writing a little bit, running a poetry night in Peckham. That helped a lot because I met quite a lot of writers through that. Poets, I mean. And yeah, I just gradually started writing and sharing it with people. And then I got onto this scheme called The Complete Works, which picks 10 writers of colour and it gives you a mentor. And you have a year where you have seminars and you work together and you work closely with your mentor. And it was just really great and made me take myself more seriously as a writer and also just think about what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
And I think through that period in my mid-20s when I wasn't writing, I was thinking a lot more about myself, my identity. So I guess this is where race comes in. Up to that point, partly as a result of my upbringing and my education, I hadn't really thought about race, or I hadn't really wanted to write about myself at all. But then during that period, I thought a lot more about my relationship with my mum, she's Indonesian Chinese. I thought a lot more about that side of my family. My grandma was getting older and iller, and I started wanting to find out more about her life. She had a really dramatic life. We can't speak the same, she died a couple of years ago. We couldn't speak the same language, so I had to always go through my mum. But yeah, I mean, she lived through the war, the Japanese occupation of Indonesia. She lived through the coup in the mid-60s when hundreds of thousands of Chinese Indonesians were massacred. Her husband was arrested. She had to flee with the family to Jakarta. I mean, all this stuff happened, which I hadn't thought about. And I hadn't really thought about how that affected my mum, who was a child at the time, and how in turn that affected me. And I think it mainly affected my mum because she didn't tell me about a lot of this stuff. I think she wanted to kind of protect me from... Well, she wanted to raise me as just a basically white British kid, even though I wasn't, and hope that I'd assimilate into British culture. But yeah, it was really enriching thinking about that in my mid-20s, reading up on it and reading stuff about politics, race theory, economics, or the things I'd never really thought about before and didn't think was that relevant to me, because before I just read books, just read poems, novels, bits of literary theory. Maybe that's as close as I got to anything which might force me to think about myself.
Yeah.
And then there's the usual trajectory in poetry, which is you start publishing in magazines, you publish a little pamphlet, and then someone asks to see a book manuscript, if you're lucky.
I noticed, yeah, that all this is implied is referred to as a pamphlet, which made me laugh because...
It made you laugh.
Yeah, because pamphlet just doesn't seem like a serious enough term for a collection of poems.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it seems really disposable, like a single sheet of paper with like the date of the next church fete written on it.
Yeah, or something you'd pick up at the doctor's or something. Is pamphlet actually the word that is used?
It is the word that's used, yeah. taken very seriously. The pamphlet scene is thriving at the moment.
So how did your essay Mixed Race Superman come about?
So through the period where I wasn't writing poetry, I had started writing a bit of prose and been writing. I wrote some essays. I started keeping a blog. That was really useful, actually, because I can often get quite precious about writing and just putting it onto somewhere. And also pitching obviously takes so long with prose. And that was really, I found that really tortuous. You know, where you work on something for ages and then you pitch it and then they take 2 weeks to get back to you and then it's out of date. So I set up a blog and it, obviously only my friends read it, but that was good. That was something. And I entered this competition, I think it was the Fitzcarraldo Essay Prize. And I had this proposal for a book about mixed race identities in literature and in culture and film. And it was shortlisted. So I didn't get the book deal, but then this new press called Peninsula, they messaged me and asked if I had any ideas for a new essay series they were going to run, and I just sent them four ideas off the top of my head, one of which was an essay about mixed race identities focusing on Keanu Reeves and Barack Obama as kind of two different kinds of superhero who embodied also different forms of masculinity. And they liked it, and then I had to write it, which was great.
It's brilliant.
I probably wouldn't have written it if I hadn't, in that coffee shop, came up with the idea and then got myself into a situation where I had to within like 5 months.
So you have in the essay, you return again and again to Keanu Reeves and Barack Obama and the different ways that they represent what it is to be mixed race and the different ways that they represent this idea of being heroic. Why did you zone in on those two people?
I think, to be honest, it was pretty arbitrary. I just thought it was funny at the time, which I actually think is a good enough justification. There have been a few like fairly po-faced responses along the lines of, why is he comparing Barack Obama and Keanu Reeves? They're nothing, you know. But I mean, it seemed like an obviously good idea to me because they're so different, and yet they're both mixed race men.
Yeah.
I mean,
and sort of iconic, I guess, in their own ways.
And they're iconic, yeah. And I guess Keanu Reeves passes as white, Barack Obama doesn't. And the more I dug into it, the more they did seem kind of iconically different or different in representative ways. So Keanu Reeves is incredibly famously evasive in interviews. He refuses to kind of answer questions in a yes or no way. Particularly, this was a big thing in the 90s where he refused to deny or affirm whether he was straight or gay, even when there were like absolutely ludicrous rumors circling at the time. And he's kind of built an identity around being this slightly diffuse, mysterious, kind of pansexual being. Whereas Obama has this kind of completely solid trajectory. I mean, especially if you read Dreams from My Father, which is about him kind of piecing together his identity, discovering himself, taking on this kind of heroic mantle to the point where he can kind of single-handedly lift America out of its like racial, yeah, out of the... Or actually, the analogy he uses, or that other people have used, is to wash or to kind of dissolve the natural sin of slavery and of racial injustice.
I thought there's a really interesting bit where you talk about a speech that he gave. Sorry, I have the most hopeless memory, so I can't remember the details of what the speech was for. But
they are famously very similar, his speeches.
You talked about how I think it was some commentators afterwards said that he was sort of ushering in a new era of America embracing you know, a post-racial politics. And you said that actually, if you look at the content of the speech, really what he was doing was making all of that more palatable for white Americans to embrace him as a, you know, he was building up traditional America with the speech.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting.
Well, yeah, it was the famous Better Union speech, which he gave in the Democratic primaries when he was still, he was kind of pulling ahead of Hillary Clinton at the time. But and then this video emerged of his old pastor in Chicago giving this kind of fiery speech about racism in the US. And he suddenly had to give a speech about race, which he managed to avoid thus far.
Mm.
And he did this thing, which was like typical Obama, of managing to kind of dodge the issue by saying, by drawing on his own biography, by basically saying, I'm the child of a migrant, an African migrant, and also of a racist white woman. Well, he actually referred to his grandmother, who would say racist things sometimes. You know, so he contains the kind of contradiction of America within him.
Mm.
And so he kind of, yeah, so he made his story the portal for America, kind of overcoming its history of discrimination and injustice, which was, yeah, which I kind of, you can see now has kind of caused a lot of problems. I mean, it led to this huge backlash against him personally, but it didn't really solve any of the underlying issues of inequality in America, you know.
Yeah.
Ferguson in 2014 happened under his presidency. Black Lives Matter formed. And yeah, I mean, I think it's sad in lots of ways. I mean, it emboldened the far right in the US at the same time as not really making the positive progressive changes that he campaigned on or that a lot of people attached to him when he was running for office.
Yeah. You're very good at weaving together the personal and the political, which makes your work very moving. And I wondered whether you feel that there's an element of the activist in you or wanting to actually affect change with your work.
I wouldn't have any problem being thought of as an activist. I would say any activist would probably think of me as a bad activist because, well, the way I write is very slow and I think quite idiosyncratic. I find it quite difficult to take up clear positions. I mean, even the way I wrote Mixed Race Superman, it was more like I thought of it as a poem kind of composed out of different argumentative strands. And to be an activist, even as a writer, I think you need to have a clear argument that you need to hammer home, and I find that difficult, even though I really love it in others and appreciate it. It feels like a really pressing question at the moment because I don't know when this podcast is going to go out, but we're writing after, you know, in the wake of the George Floyd murder, this wave of global protests, the toppling of these statues of slave traders and people implicated in the slave trade all over Europe and the world. And it feels like when these things happen, it reminds me that, I guess like you said, not that I weave together the personal and the political, but that the political touches everything, every part of our lives.
Mm.
And everything I do hopefully will reflect some sense of that, and I wish I could contribute more. I often think that I want to do more, but I often find myself too anxious and too slow and too kind of passive to really contribute as much as I'd want to.
I think there's room for different kinds of contributions. I mean, you don't want everybody who contributes to change to be the person who's standing in the front of the crowd with a megaphone. That would be, you know, nightmarish.
I don't think anyone would want me in that position either.
You maybe not an obvious fit for it.
That would not be helpful for the cause.
I there was a bit in Mixed Race Superman that I wrote down. You said, "It's easy to feel like the true aim of all conversation and all art should be some sort of ecstatic revelation. And if we don't achieve that, we've failed." And that really resonated with me in the context of, as you say, everything that's going on at the moment, because it feels as though, and maybe this is because I spend too much time on Twitter, but it feels as though the discussion at the moment around structural racism is so complicated and confused and often difficult, emotionally difficult. Sometimes it's hard to know whether it's constructive or not. But do you think that?
Yeah.
I sort of felt like reading your essay, you were sort of saying, even if we don't come to a sort of clear conclusion, it's still worth discussing and exploring.
Completely. And shifting the onus from personal revelation to thinking more communally, more socially. Because structural problems can only be solved by structural change and by thinking in broader terms. I mean, as much, it isn't really about each of us individually, it's about each of us together. I know that sounds kind of abstract, but I guess I've been frustrated, and I'm constantly frustrated by Twitter and also a lot of journalistic coverage, which tries to give answers, which says, read these books, do this, that will solve racism. And that's not really what it's about. And that's not what activists are fighting for. They want, the only thing we can do is, particularly at this moment, I think, or especially if you are in a position of privilege, is to kind of listen and sit with the difficulty and
reflect.
And reflect on the voices of the people within society who are most oppressed and who, for a moment, at times of crisis, I guess, like in the present moment, their voices come to the surface. And what frustrates me is that then their voices immediately get drowned out by all these people coming forward to kind of denounce their own privilege and to talk about what they're going to do that's going to be different and how they're going to change it, when it shouldn't be about that. It should be about thinking, it should be about listening to those people.
Yeah.
The oppressed, and reflecting how we got to this point as a society where there is this level of continuing structural oppression, this level of poverty, this level of, how we're failing Black communities on every part of civil society.
Going back to your poetry, how do you feel that it has developed over the years? I mean, do you feel that you are a better poet now than you were, 7 years ago, for example?
Seven years ago, I was good. That was actually a good
8 years ago.
8 years, yeah. I'm probably better than him.
I suppose what I'm asking is, what are the things that have helped you to get better at what you do?
I try not to think of it in terms of better and worse, just in the same way in which I try not to think of poems as good or bad. I think about what the author was trying to do and what that work does for me. And I guess that's how I feel about my work as well. I could point to ways in which the stuff I wrote when I was 16 was bad, but then it's not really, it's not like objectively bad. It's that the problem then was that I wasn't expressing what I wanted to express. I wasn't using, for me, I wasn't using poetry as a way of understanding myself and my place within the world. And I think that's what I became more able to do in my late 20s.
You tapped into the things that you actually wanted to talk about.
Yeah. And I think I managed to, I think a big thing actually was starting to go to therapy first time. That really made a big difference. And I think because for a long time I'd have problems with over-editing or with writer's block. I just get stuck on things. And then actually the process of talking to someone each week and just following a kind of chain of thought and connections, which you have to do in therapy when you're talking to someone, was really then kind of filtered back into my writing. And it opened up in lots of ways. I started including conversations with people, meetings with people on the street. I opened it up to places, to friends, and I think it became less restrictive. It became more reflective of my life and my experience.
Yeah.
And that was a more rewarding process for me. And I think that's the only thing that matters. That matters whether it's rewarding your work for you, not whether it's good.
Yeah. It's so funny that you say that about therapy, because you're only the second poet that I've had on this podcast, and the first one was Wendy Cope, and she also said that she became a much better poet as a result of therapy. I think it was, in her case, it was psychoanalysis. Again, that's really interesting. Yeah, that there's perhaps a sort of release as a result of maybe getting a bit more in touch with what's going on in your head or something.
Yeah, especially if you're a particular kind of person. I mean, I'd had an interest in therapy and psychoanalysis for years and read a lot about it. And for some reason, I thought that because I'd read about it and I had a basic understanding of some of the main terms, I didn't need to do it myself. But it was so transformative to be in that space and to just have to talk to someone, just have to talk for an hour about myself. And it's really hard to express the change that makes opening yourself up to that kind of space, that experience.
Yeah. You still teach, is that right? At the poetry school?
I teach at the poetry school and run workshops from time to time, different places.
Would you share one or two things perhaps that you find yourself saying to students a lot?
Well, I have recommended therapy, that's one thing. But within the workshop itself, or if you're trying to create a space to write, free writing is a big thing. I mean, that helps a lot, writing first thing in the morning, just letting yourself. One way I often describe it, one useful way of thinking about the page for me is often as a kind of vessel or a beaker, and to think of yourself as filling the page, so kind of like filling it up with water. And if you get yourself to do that at the beginning of a writing session or even at the beginning of the day, it's even better, then that can be really helpful, I think, in terms of freeing yourself up. Doing little, just reorienting yourself to your practice in different ways. I mean, if you find it hard to write, just forcing yourself to write.
Just to write anything.
Yeah, just write anything.
And looking at your writing, what are you proudest of?
That's a pretty hard question. maybe because that suggests I'm proud of anything that I've done.
This is how writers always respond. Yeah. People immediately, actually quite often when I ask people what they're proudest of, their first reaction is to tell me something they're not proud of.
Well, I think, because my main experience of writing, and I'm sure is true of most writers, is of shame, of constant shame, not being good enough, not having done justice to something, or the process of actually writing about certain things, disclosing certain things, you don't often feel pride at having done it. There is a kind of shame at that act of disclosure, which writing often is. And so it feels almost strange to me to talk about it in terms of, I was glad I did that. I guess, one of the poems in my book towards the end, a longer poem called Say. That was a really important poem for me. I think I wrote that after I hadn't been writing for a little bit, and then I wrote it very quickly on the back of a piece of paper, and I think on a flight, actually. It was on the back of an e-ticket on a Ryanair flight. I wrote the first draft of it. And yeah, I hadn't written for a few months because my dad had been ill. He'd been quite seriously ill, and he'd had cancer, and he was well by that point. He'd had a really almost miraculous recovery, considering how bad it was and how unhealthy his lifestyle had been. But anyway, he was okay, but I hadn't really written for a few months, and then I just wrote this poem, which was about my dad, my relationship to my dad, and about writing itself, I guess, my relationship to it. And I mean, I didn't just write it on that flight. I then spent the next few months working on it every day from 6 a.m. till 8 in the morning. But that really did feel like I dislodged something inside of me. And like it had made new things possible. And I was happy with that.
That was Will Harris. His debut collection of poetry is Rendang, out now, and his essay, which you can also buy at all good bookshops, is Mixed Race Superman. Today's episode was brought to you by Arvon, the UK's leading provider of residential creative writing courses. Book in for their new digital programme, Arvon at Home, which brings their acclaimed roster of creative writing tutors into the comfort of your home for readings, masterclasses, one-to-ones and writing weeks. Find out more at arvon.org. If you enjoyed the episode, please do share it online, and thank you for listening. See you next time.